Radio.
Pope Francis's Message of Mercy, a talk by Father David Braithwaite, SJ, at Evenings with Pope Francis.
Pope Francis on Mercy. It's a wonderful topic to have to talk about, because if you've read his stuff and heard his stuff, which I know you have, you'll know that really mercy, I think, not just because I'm talking on it tonight, but I think it's fair to say it's probably the centre of what he's saying. It comes across so much in everything he says. I'll read this quote to you. God's passionate love for his people, for humanity, is at the same time a forgiving love. It is so great that it turns God against himself, his love against his justice. That's a profound and arresting statement. It's provocative. And you might be surprised to know it's actually from Pope Emeritus Benedict. And I say that to begin because I think it's so important that we see everything Francis is saying and doing being consistent with the magisterium, with the teaching of the whole church, and with his deeply holy and intellectual predecessor, Pope Benedict. What we've got to remember with Francis is we're seeing often what the secular media want to give us, in a sense. Now, there's definitely a change. We know that, his style. And Pope Benedict, I think, alluded to that recently. But let's just recall that continuity on this teaching of mercy. And who was the Pope of Divine Mercy? John Paul II. So I just think that's important to orient what we're doing here. Having said that, like I said, there are really important differences, I think, emerging, or emphases that are just different. Some of it's perception and media angle. Some of it's real, I think we can say too. And at Bernard's invitation, I'm here because I am a Jesuit priest. So what I'll try and offer you in my own limited way is an understanding, an angle, if you will, on that particular tradition within our larger tradition that Francis comes out of. So I'm going to be postulating here. These are hypotheses, but I think given from the point of view of another Jesuit, how it's shaped and it's continuing to shape his pontificate. You'll be aware of that recent interview. It's a 12,000-word interview that Francis gave to an Italian Jesuit journalist and academic that then got printed in 12 different international or separate Jesuit journals. At the beginning of that interview, I think his name's Spadaro, the guy, I think he's from the Gregorian, he kind of stumped the Pope with that question, who is Jorge Bergoglio? And I think it's worth me quoting it to you to remind you of it. So the journalist says, the Pope continues to reflect and concentrate as if he did not expect the question, which I think is fair enough. Yeah, it's a tough question. As if he were forced to reflect further. His answer, yes, perhaps I can say that I'm a bit astute, that I can adapt to circumstances, which is also, I might say, a very Jesuit ideal to be that way. But it is also true that I'm a bit naive. Yes, but the best summary, the one that comes more from the inside, and I feel most true, is this. I am a sinner whom the Lord has looked upon. And he repeats, I am one who is looked upon by the Lord. His motto, you know, he says, I always felt my motto, miserando atque elegendo, or elegendo, by having mercy and by choosing him, was very true for me. The journalist goes on, the motto is taken from the homilies of Bede the Venerable, who writes in his comments on the gospel story of the calling of Matthew. Jesus saw a publican, this is the quote from the Venerable Bede, and since he looked at him with feelings of love and chose him, he said to him, follow me. The Pope adds, I think the Latin gerund miserando is impossible to translate in both Italian and Spanish, and I think we could add English to that. I like to translate it with another gerund that does not exist, misericordiando, which is translated from this Italian interview as mercying. Personally, I think this is almost really the most striking thing that I've read that Francis has said thus far. Of course, while focusing in the interview on his own intimate calling from God and the response to this mercying love, the Pope is telling us what kind of church we need to be. We should desire to be. That is, if we have understood the Gospels. We must share in and experience for ourselves the mercying of God, to give that mercying to others. What in our language is held as a noun, we must enact. We must make it into a verb, he's saying. I think it's the most wonderful thing. Mercy is such a beautiful and central reality of our faith, a dogma of our tradition, because it is always absolutely inseparable from the love God has for us. We are called into the most intimate, life-giving relationship with a God who cares so deeply, he offers us salvation at every moment and at every turn. Francis is telling us to believe in this love, to not place obstacles to it, to know it in our hearts and then sing with joy that our God has given his only Son that we might live in this love. We can be healed. That's his message. We can be healed. The brokenness of the world, the sin in our own hearts, the constant flow of tragedy on the news, the war, the pestilence, the abuse, the terror. These are not the whole story. Love does conquer all, but not in some soppy, romantic, you know, secular appropriation. It's not mere human love in its frailty, but divine love shared with us that heals and elevates, that makes us whole again. There's that beautiful image from St. Thomas Aquinas in his Summa, where he plays on the fact, the metaphor that Christ was the carpenter. And Thomas has this flight of metaphor for a moment in his densely argued logic. He says, we're like a chair or a piece of furniture that needs to be repaired. It's basically good, but it needs the Saviour's touch to repair and restore it. Which is the point. We are good in as much as we are created by a perfectly good and loving creator. It's logically impossible for a good God to create anything that by its nature is not also good, albeit imperfect. We need to remind ourselves of that fundamental teaching of the Catholic faith. The image of God in which we are made is not damaged beyond repair. Our wills and our intellects can cooperate in our own salvation. Crucially, our sin is not the same as our weakness, or what we might call finitude, our limitedness, which is a consequence of being human. Our nature is good, our tendency to sin is not. This is one of the most important distinctions, I think, in Catholic theology. It gives us hope of salvation, and on it rests our dignity and our capacity for freedom. If we were damaged beyond repair, and this is the rhetoric really of some of Luther's statements and Calvinist or Reformed theological statements, that there is a sense in which sin has so corrupted the human person that there is nothing in the human person left that can cooperate with God's grace. That's not Catholic understanding. And it's not some Protestant understanding too these days, right? But the fact is we can cooperate because of this extraordinary image which gives us freedom and reason too, of course. It would also be the theological basis, when you think about it, for joy. If it were not possible for us to respond to God's love freely, it would be very difficult to find a basis for joy in this world. Anyway, and yet, unless we come to terms with our tendency to sin and our reality of sin, we will never be able to receive the grace that comes from divine mercy. Our arrogance and foolishness will block the striving of God's love to reach us. We can make it so difficult when what is being offered is given so freely. This seems to be something that comes through with Francis too. You know, there's a gentleness and a joyfulness to him. The life of faith needn't be unnecessarily harsh. It needn't be life negating. It's life affirming, the goodness of the world. He embraces the goodness of the world, searching for God in all things, which is if you know or not, that was one of St. Ignatius's, the founder of the Jesuits, constant refrains, to seek God in all things. Not to say God is in all things, well, necessarily, but to find God in all things. That anything that has been created necessarily shares at least a trace of God's presence. The world is still full of sin, there is still evil within and without. But this extraordinary optimism that is at the basis, frankly, of Ignatian spirituality and of Francis's attitude towards the world is good. If you move out into the world, you needn't be scared, you needn't hide from the world. You can embrace the world as God's creation, discerningly. You discern what is good and what is not as good, what you should do, using the reason you've been given and the freedom by God. Now, I was saying I'd give some a Jesuit angle, well, I have, but I want to talk a little bit more about the spiritual exercises. The combination of an emphasis on God's abounding, loving mercy and the innate goodness of human beings is very Ignatian, as I was saying. St. Ignatius was a champion of the use of all our gifts as a way of glorifying God, to whom we owe our gifts. He insisted that Jesuits and others who wish to share in the spirituality undergo the spiritual exercises, he wrote, so that they could experience giving themselves in love to Jesus Christ in the most intimate exchange of divine human friendship. He often speaks, when you do the exercises, if you do the silent 30-day retreat, or if you do them in other modes, at the end of your prayer, he encourages you to engage in what he calls a colloquy, which is, he says, it should be heart to heart, as if you were talking to your best friend. That level of intimacy, allowing yourself to be laid bare and to trust. So the exercises are about developing this personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, but in preparation for this prayer to receive divine love, which is what you build up to in the exercises, to get to that, the first week focuses on the reality of sin and of hell. You cannot complete the exercises unless you have first recognized yourself as a sinner in need of divine mercy. The meditation on hell is not to scare yourself into following the rules. It's to scare yourself with the possibility of your freedom being abused, that you could sever your relationship with God against his will and against your own nature. Now that terror needs to sink in. The terror of the freedom we're given. That's what Ignatius wants, not for its own sake, because it's part of the reality of the spiritual life. You can't have divine friendship with... The primary point is that you are loved beyond imagining before all time. That love cannot be removed. So you don't meditate on sin with someone unless you know that they are loved by God in the first place. Otherwise, all you'll get is more misery. And the evil spirit will use the focus on sin to destroy a person's spiritual life. To know that you are loved by God beyond imagining, and nothing can sever that love except your own abuse of freedom, that's the starting point. Your blessed history. But you can't get to the depths, really, of the exercises without acknowledging your sin. Otherwise, there's no sense of your freedom. Owned, you know. Mercy is not the mere application of the law. The word mercy, in our normal usage anyway, exceeds the law. By definition, mercy is a completion of justice, divine justice. To return to Pope Benedict's quote, it turns love against itself, against his justice. Divine mercy and divine justice are the same in God, in the simplicity of God. And no human mind can begin to comprehend the awesome mystery in that. It is the heart of our faith. Jesus Christ is the divine mercy and the divine justice of the Father given to us in perfect love. So Pope Francis's focus on mercy within the all-embracing and original love of God, before us, we're loved since the foundation of the world. We were intended. That is entirely consistent with his spiritual formation as a Jesuit in the spiritual exercises. Another observation I'd like to make about his Jesuit origins and mercy is that it's missionary. Our own relationship with Jesus Christ, our understanding of ourselves as a sinner forgiven, it has to be the core of our life, really. But it doesn't stop in the private solace of my the chapel or my bedroom. It's for others. Otherwise, it's reduced. And once again, the evil spirit will turn that experience into something self, only self-relating. Okay. The Jesuits, you know, we're a missionary order. Wherever we are. Not if you're just in the missions. We're missionaries. We're formed to always find ways to engage with those outside the church and to bring them the story of love that is the Gospels. And I think it is fair to say Jesuits will go to extraordinary lengths to do this and have run foul of some other Catholics over the centuries for being less interested in specifically European historical and cultural expressions of Christian faith. Okay. Now that's my version of it. You know, I'm sure at times we know Jesuits have gone too far, but it's nice to understand it sympathetically, at least if you're a Jesuit. Thus, the Jesuits who followed the conquistadors and merchants to the corners of the known globe, we're talking now the 17th century mainly, would spend years learning the languages of where they were being sent, often before they even arrived. So Ignatius sometimes would make them wait nearby to learn the languages. They would dress as Confucian intellectuals, you know, like Ricci did famously, and entered the Forbidden City. Came, on some accounts, not that far from converting the emperor. And he used his mathematical knowledge, his scientific knowledge, to build a clock, a water clock, that dazzled them. But he came very close. That's a whole history if you want to read up on the Chinese rites as well, when the Jesuits were expelled from China. They would, by the church, not by the Chinese, they would also dress as Indian holy men. Denobili did this. To understand the culture, to gain entree, to bring Jesus Christ to them. I know a Jesuit in India, an amazing man. He grew up in Sydney, went to a Jesuit school. At the age of 20, went across as a missionary after he took his vows. Hans Hendricks. And Hans was very close to Mother Teresa. I think Hans is a very holy man. He dresses as a wandering holy man, still to this day. And he began his ministry. It took him 10 years for the first conversion. He was with a nun who was a nurse, and all he did was pray and tend the sick and the poor with this nurse who helped them. After 10 years, the first family came to him and said, we would like to know your faith more deeply and join you. Then 10,000 families eventually joined him. And if you go into the jungle and into the middle of nowhere, you'll find schools and hospitals built. It's incredible. And these are the Santali people. And he's adopted his own, it's approved by the Episcopal Conference in India, but he's got a special rite where he sits on the floor and uses dung because it's actually more hygienic, kills a chicken as a sacrifice, and then begins the Mass. Now, it might sound crazy to us, and if we did it here with no Santali people, it would be ridiculous. But it's about bringing people Jesus Christ in whatever way works. We know that Pope Francis... Oh, well, the other thing too I'll say in about that, and I think it helps me understand Francis. There is this intimacy of his relationship with Jesus Christ that inspires him. It's also his bedrock. So there's no need to be scared of other faiths. And when you engage with them in honesty, because you and he is so grounded in his deep love in Jesus Christ, he's not at risk of losing his faith by speaking to people of other faiths or atheists. That gives an extraordinary freedom. Precisely because of this core identity, there's a peace and a confidence in that engagement and a genuine openness. He's clearly a missionary. He wants mercy to be at the heart of that strategy of the church. If strategy is the right word. It's, of course, at the heart of the Gospels, But there's a strong sense in his words that he sees the world more than ever in need of being shown and taught the need for mercy. Now, I think this might be what he's about, and I'm presuming a bit here, but I think he knows that for many that involves discovering for the first time the sin that needs to be mercied. Surely, in our cultural setting now, this is an extraordinary problem, pastorally, a sickness, if you will, the lack of a sense of sin. How can we preach mercy when people don't believe they're in need of it? It's a genuine pastoral problem. And I think it is a good question. It highlights something, perhaps, and I don't want to just be controversial here for the sake of being it. There can be a cultural divide with some Catholics who agree, of course, with Francis's emphasis on mercy, but who perhaps are concerned, and I know I've spoken to a couple of these people, that the Church is dying in the West. At least it is. It can feel that way here, right? And it needs to clarify its identity by preaching on the differences we offer the world, as well as what the world wants to hear. And I don't believe for a second Francis is giving the world what it wants to hear. If they really understood and listened to what he's saying about mercy, he's actually saying, get to the heart of your own sin and realize you're loved by God, but seek God's forgiveness. Now, the media don't write that up, but that's what he's doing. That's very clear. So if we stay with this idea, it's important to realize Francis is not offering cheap grace. Grace is given abundantly if we ask for it. But cheap implies I don't have to have the spiritual journey. I don't need to know my reality. I can somehow just get it. Forgiveness without conversion doesn't make sense. It's not in the Gospels. He's inviting the world into a relationship with the God of love, and once that relationship is embarked upon, it will lead to a grasp of one's need for healing and one's acceptance of one's sin. There can be no true faith that does not know this truth. I am first and foremost a sinner, says the Pope. And it only means anything within that constant stream of God's love. Otherwise, it would be an utterly dismal statement if it wasn't covered in the love and beginning with that love. That exchange of love is at the very base of the mystery of our existence as Christians, as human beings. By promoting mercy, he is not washing out Catholic identity. He's bringing it home, I think. And I think that's because the world doesn't understand mercy, because it doesn't understand sin. It knows the reality of evil. I don't believe there'd be an atheist you could meet who couldn't accept that the world needs saving. They mightn't believe there's a saviour, but no one can look at the world and say it doesn't need saving. But to talk about the importance of grasping one's own capacity for sin, one's own role in that, and the possibility that we can be forgiven. This is the other thing too. To say that forgiveness and mercy to be preached is what the world wants to hear. I don't think the world believes in forgiveness, really. Not in the sense the gospel means. To forgive the unforgivable, we might say, is extraordinary. It requires grace. I don't understand how, and I've, for example, I think of an essay once read by a Jewish philosopher, and he said, enough of this forgiveness stuff, talking about the Holocaust. He said, enough, it's Christian. He said, I don't want to forgive. I lost my family. I'm not forgiving. And I'm not forgetting. This idea of forgiveness is a specifically Christian idea, one we're talking about. That you can be forgiven by God Almighty, and it is not forgotten in a literal sense. It's wiped away. God's relationship to that event in your life, your own relationship to that memory, the hurt you've hurt others with. It's not obliterated, but it's certainly erased, if you know what I mean. This is where it gets interesting spiritually. It's your relationship to that past. It's not as if you can wake up and just totally forget, because I don't think that's what grace does. Your relationship to those memories of yourself are enriched by the knowledge that you were forgiven, that you have experienced God's mercy, and you can share that now with others. It is missionary. Now, Francis is challenging the world. The more they read, the more they listen to him, I think they'll begin to get that. Now, this is not an easy message. And I think in terms of our Catholic identity markers, which we do need, you know, I mean, the world can be, not always, but certainly the work I'm engaged in now around the universities, it's, you know, there's a great hostility, and I'm sure you would have experienced that. Hostility, a kind of aggressive secularism, this Dawkins, you know, third-rate philosophy. It's really penetrated people's hearts and minds. It's an excuse, right, in many ways, but it's real. And I think it's very important that we do mark our identity as Catholics in that sea, if you like. But mercy and forgiveness should be at the heart of our identity as Catholics. You know, a mercy and a forgiveness the world doesn't always want to know. Or a cheap grace, a cheap forgiveness the world doesn't want to know. The last thing I'll say, and this, none of this is exclusively Jesuit, but there's an emphasis in it which corresponds with Jesuit concerns for the world, if you like, that missionary impetus. We know from Francis that his story of mercy and forgiveness has social and political consequences. So if there are Catholics who say the Church should stay out of politics, be very wary of them, because the Gospels don't seem to, I don't think the Gospels say that, and Francis isn't saying that. I didn't hear Benedict really say that either. Benedict spoke about refugees. It didn't get the airplay that Francis's comments have. And John Paul II certainly stood side by side. He threatened to stand side by side with the workers at Gdansk, you know, the unionists. And because of that threat, they didn't send the tanks in, on some accounts. So we are in the world as Catholics. Our faith is not a hidden private matter. It should be public, and we should be prepared to pay a price at times for that, you know, if we live under the law of the cross. But Francis is saying the mercy I want for the world to know it has consequences for refugees. You know, the first place he went deliberately as Pope overseas was Lampedusa, which is the island the refugees come to. He went to visit the first Jesuit house after the General Curia house he went to was the refugee centre in the centre of Rome, which is a kind of a social service centre for mainly North African Muslim refugees. He, you know, he's very deliberate, we know that. We know he's setting the agenda. And it's not just about refugees, but it is about that. What would the world look like if it was genuinely mercying? If we really believed in forgiveness and love too, what would our law and order debate look like in this state? What would our politics look like if we insisted on that depth of human experience, that we wanted mature spiritual men, whatever their faith, but certainly the Christian faith, that could articulate this specifically, I think, Christian idea of forgiving the unforgivable? Final point too, when the secular world has appropriated these ideas but has missed the spiritual depth. And I think we need to remind the world of that. You know, this is an intimate relationship between the God and ourselves, and I need to be real about my sin, because then I can experience the joy of being forgiven, the incredible joy, you know, the irrepressible joy that explains the saints and the martyrs, explains people you meet. I mean, I'm blessed in my work. I get to go to some very remote parts of the world, and I have met some of the most wonderful, holy people, especially some nuns I've met. I often say to the people, young people I work with, you know, you can go to lots of war-torn places or difficult places. You might find a Jesuit, but you will always find a nun, you know, and they'll be in places that other people have given up going to. But the joy I've seen in those people, those women, There's an orphanage I go to in central Vietnam with groups, and they're heavily disabled children. Some of them are completely paralyzed. And those young nuns are just incredible. They're young and old, but they're just, they're always in fits of laughter. Whatever happens, they're always, it's no big deal if, you know, the kid is sick or whatever in the dining room. That's just, how do you explain that? That's grace. Anyway, I got distracted by that. But they're some of the most wonderful people I've ever met. So I think I'll finish with that. Francis's message could be summed up with that word he gave us, mercying. Thanks.
That was Father David Braithwaite with Pope Francis's message of mercy. Evenings with Pope Francis was an initiative of Catholic Youth Services Sydney. And for more interviews, talks, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.